Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I don't really want to introduce my next guest, Dana Gioia, a poet, in a sort of standard fashion. I mean, I could talk about how he's former chairman of the National Endowments for the Arts, probably saved that institution, or how he's got 5 books of poetry, the most latest being 99 poems, new and selected, which we talked about on this show a year ago, or about he's received, you know, a whole bushel bag full of honors and recognitions and awards. I really just want to say about Dana Gioia that I'm proud to be his friend. I'm proud to be a friend of the man who has, I'm not going to say single-handedly, but at least in a tremendous leadership fashion, championed not just poetry, but literacy, literature, reading, reciting. He's a man who really has strengthened the humanities and respect for it in the United States, if not also abroad. So, Dana, welcome to Church and Culture.
I blush hearing your, you know, your introduction. I'm glad to be back on this show.
Well, I am too. And we miss you having you here in Washington, but at least you kind of help balance the cultural scene out there in California.
I had a great time in Washington, but I don't miss being there.
Oh, I know. Well, you're now at USC, and you're the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture. Really jealous of your students. But I want to talk about a couple of things today. First of all, I want to congratulate you for becoming a recording artist.
Yes, you know, relatively late in life, but better late than never.
Because you have a new CD out, which, of course, we can download or however we want to hear it, but it's very unusual. Tell our audience about this, and I've listened to the whole thing, and I'm not a big jazz guy, but I was totally enthralled by it. Tell our listeners about it.
Well, you know, about 7-8 years ago, I met this fantastic young jazz pianist. Her name was Helen Sung, and you know, she and I, you know, met, we talked about jazz, and, you know, and she didn't like poetry. She said that she felt very uncomfortable with poetry. She didn't know if she understood it. So I said, well, you know, with poetry, it's not about understanding it. It's about feeling it. It's about hearing it. If you're a musician, you have everything you need, you know, to appreciate poetry. And she started reading poetry, and she just fell in love with it. And I went to hear a concert of hers one night, and almost toward the end of the concert, she said, now I'm going to do something new for me. It's a song, and it has words by Dana Gioia.
and you didn't know this was going to happen?
No, I didn't know it was going to happen. And she said that she wanted to surprise me. And then she asked me if I might want to work with her on an album of jazz songs. And we began talking. If you go back, not that long ago, jazz was the most popular music in the world. I'm talking about the 30s, the 40s.
Yeah, absolutely. Starting in Paris in the 20s. Yeah.
Yeah, and so one of the things that characterized jazz then was that it had songs. You know, there were popular songs that were written in an idiom that jazz musicians could then do instrumentals of, and frankly, some of the most famous recordings of standard, you'd say, Tin Pan Alley songs,
yeah,
American songbook songs.
Irving Berlin, also, Cole Porter, et cetera.
Yeah, if you look at the recordings, on the recording is not only a great vocalist, but, you know, there are great pianists, you know, great instrumentalists, Benny Goodman, you know, Lester Young, you know, Duke Ellington.
Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong. And, more probably even, you know, with even within my, you know, personal memory, Stan Getz doing these Bruce songs, you know, like the girl from Ipanema.
Ipanema, yes.
And so I said, you know, one of the reasons I think jazz has lost its popularity is that it's lost touch with songs, because the song gives the average, you know, listener an entryway into jazz. You know, it's less interesting to hear somebody doing variations if you don't recognize the melody.
Right. I mean, isn't the whole, isn't jazz, I mean, correct me, but the jazz I know starts off with a recognizable song that the public knows, and then goes into elaborate variations.
Yeah, and so you take the audience with you on your musical journey. So anyway, you know, over the, you know, the past, you know, really 5-6 years, you know, Helen and I have been, you know, working on this. We have premiered songs at various places. We did some concerts in New York and Boston. You know, one of the first versions of them, and finally, about 2 weeks ago, we formally released the album. And it's a very elaborate production in some ways. She has a, you know, a septet, two vocalists, a brass section, you know, and it's, you know, she's, you know, created a wonderful combination of instrumental and vocal jazz.
Hold on just a second. Let's play the very first cut. It's only a minute long, where you recite Meet Me at the Lighthouse.
Meet me at the lighthouse in Hermosa Beach. That shabby nightclub on its foggy pier. Let's aim for the summer of 71, when all our friends were young and immortal. I'll pick up the cover charge, find us a table, and order a round of their watery drinks. Let's savor the smoke of that sinister century. Perfume of tobacco in the tangy salt air. The crowd will be quiet. Only ghosts at the bar. So you, old friend, won't feel out of place. Time and tide are counting the beats. Meet me at the lighthouse.
Well, you know, that's so evocative, just that short cut. I think anyone listening to that will immediately want to know more about this recording. I did. That was the perfect pull in for me.
Yeah, and I should point out, the Lighthouse is a real place. It's this, you know, jazz club in Hermosa Beach, California. And even if you don't know it, most people have probably seen it, because that's the club that they used 3 times in La La Land.
Oh, that where they're doing the dancing?
Yeah. And so, you know, and when I was young, my cousin and I, you know, used to go there, because they never carded you. I mean, I hate to say that. We were drinking below the age of 21, but the drinks at the White House were so watered down.
You're lucky you're not a Supreme Court nominee.
I know. But anyway, my cousin passed away, and so the poem is a remembrance of the Lighthouse. It's a remembrance of him. It's a remembrance of hearing all these great jazz artists that have passed away. And so, you know, it has a kind of elegiac tone.
Well, I remember the summer of 71. I had just graduated from college.
And, it was a good time to be young.
Yes. And, Dana, the other side of our interview, and we're not going to get there yet, because this fits in perfectly with the essay you wrote about the state of poetry in America, for, I guess it was the introduction to a book you edited called The Best American Poetry of 2018. It was reprinted on the internet at the Los Angeles Book Review, or Review of Books, where I saw it. But I would say that this CD that you've done with Helen Sung is a perfect example of the kind of rise in poetic activity in the United States. In other words, it's not coming from the places it used to come from.
Yeah, we are speaking at a very interesting moment for American poetry. For decades, the poetry experts, the academic experts, have told us that poetry is a dying art, it's an elite art, it's an art that's really, you know, for artists writing for one another and for intellectuals, and, you know, saying there really is nothing, you know, nothing we can do with this because, you know, poetry is the, you know, is this kind of language of the super, you know, sophisticated. You know, I'm from working people. My mother never had much schooling, but she loved poetry. These members of my family, they were immigrants. They loved poetry. And so I never accepted the notion, you know, that poetry was something, you know, that could only be appreciated by an elite few. Now, you know, I have staked my career in some ways on believing that just as Shakespeare, you know, wrote poetry which the common person in the audience could respond to, but also the most sophisticated members of the audience responded to, perhaps in slightly different ways, that a real poet has the gift to speak across groups. You know, art does not so much divide people as remind them of their common humanity.
Amen.
Now, needless to say, this was an unpopular view 30 years ago, but I feel vindicated by, you know, the events of the last, you know, 10, you know, 20 years. And this last year, the National Endowment for the Arts, huge arts participation survey has demonstrated. Now, this is the most detailed arts participation survey in the world. 17,000 people who, households.
That's a big survey. Big survey.
Yeah, it's 20 times the size of a New York Times survey.
Right, and most political polls are somewhere between 600 and at most 1,000 persons.
Yeah, and this survey is done by the Census Department in households that perfectly replicate the current U.S. population.
The demographics, yeah.
Yeah, it told us that poetry is the most rapidly growing art in the United States. The reading audience for poetry, this doesn't count the people who just go to an event, public event or whatever. The reading audience of poetry has grown by 76% in the last 5 years. And this has been driven mostly by younger people, 18 to 20. It's an adult survey, by the way. It doesn't measure kids. 18 to 25, 25 to 34. And that these people are not academics. In many cases, they're not college graduates. They go across every class, you know, every ethnic group. And I believe that the reason that people are coming back to poetry is that now poets are writing in a variety of styles, and there's not just one doorway, one graduate school office doorway into the art, but there's dozens and dozens of ways in which poets reach the audience, and the audience has responded. But, you know, meanwhile, most other arts in the United States are, at best, you know, flat. In fact, some of them, like, you know, reading novels continues to, you know, to decline. So poetry is the bright spot on the American cultural scene, and a broad variety of Americans are reengaging with poetry because it's the most expressive, musical, memorable, and concise way that we use language in literature. So my mother, as a working-class Mexican woman who loved poetry, is no longer an anomaly. You know, she, in her weird way, was the vanguard of the future.
And what's really grabbed me by what you wrote that I read in the Los Angeles Review of Books is that the reading of poetry has exploded among the very group that I thought wasn't reading at all.
It's true. If you look at these younger cohorts, you know, this is basically young, you know, teenagers and young adults, they are, for the most part, not only reading less and reading less often, but they're participating in the arts less, you know, because part of the behavior of going to the arts is you get up and you go to a concert, you go up and go, you know, go to the theater, you know, you go to the church and hear a choral work, you know, all of these ways in which we tend to leave home and join a group. So the arts have not only a cultural importance, but a civic importance, because it gets people together in a room and gives us a sense of our own community. And this civic behavior, this, you know, this willingness to congregate, you know, be it in a concert hall, a church, a city hall, a community club or organization is diminishing. And so the poetry number is very important, because we know that people who read more eventually become more involved in civic things, in charities, in all of these positive communal behaviors.
You know, and you mentioned earlier all these new portals that are opening up that are challenging, if not replacing, the academic ones. That strikes me at first glance as a very good thing. Am I wrong?
Well, I think so, too. I mean, the arts have a really peculiar situation in the United States, is that arts are made everywhere in the United States, but most of the publicity, the criticism, the business side of it comes out of New York City. A little bit in terms of popular music in Los Angeles. And so there's the sense that, people, the reputations are always being made elsewhere, by people who have different sorts of lives, different sorts of interests in culture. And I think what we're seeing now is a democratization of culture, and I don't just mean that not politically, but just somebody in Albuquerque, who can make a good video, have some kind of an online journal, suddenly is on an almost equal footing with somebody in New York or London or San Francisco.
Well, actually, you point out that a lot of these poets on YouTube and so forth are getting far more eyes put on them than those who are, writing for the Oxford University Press and so forth.
Yeah. Well, I heard a shocking fact. I don't think it's been made public, but apparently the Yale Review, one of the old, academic quarterlies, a very fine magazine in its way. I mean, I've always thought it was a very good magazine, has a circulation of less than 1,000. And, and you sort of see this, you see the decline of graduate programs, you see the decline of undergraduate enrollment in the humanities. There's really a crisis because academic discussions of literature, of the arts, music, has in some cases become so narrow, so restrictive, so self-reflective. I mean, if you and I, went off to a tavern together and we just began talking about what it's like to be a Catholic intellectual, you and I are going to have a great conversation, but the person next to us is going to say, how boring these old guys are.
Exactly.
Because there's the conversations you have that are specialized conversations, and then you have the public conversations. And the dilemma of the humanities, the arts, of literature, of music in the United States is that the artists, the art critics, the scholars have increasingly forgotten or have never learned how to have a conversation which not only involves the general public, but allows the general public to take part. I mean, you can't sit there and just come and tell them, do this, like this, don't like that, this, that, and the other. Well, you really have a dialogue. And I think the inclusive dialogue, the kind of respectful dialogue with the general public, is now happening mostly in non-academic venues. Now, I'm the poet laureate of California, and I decided that for my project, I would visit all 58 counties of California. Now, California is a huge...
Right.
A lot of it, people forget about it, a lot of it's deserts, mountains, incredibly, thick forests. And so, it's beautiful to go through California, but it's also, it's not always an easy drive. Now, the majority of these counties, in fact, the substantial majority of California counties are small and rural or agricultural. So I am going to some places which have never had a poetry reading in their history. And, there is nowhere I go where I don't get an audience and I don't meet fellow writers and fellow artists. Creativity is spread all over humanity.
Yes, absolutely.
It's in every class of people, every group of people, and we've forgotten this. I mean, when I published Can Poetry Matter, some people criticized me with a phrase that was recurrent in a couple of things. They said, Joya thinks we should write poetry for truck drivers. Well, let me say something. One of my
uncles. Why not?
Truck for a long time.
Why not?
He was not a dumb guy. But, you know, it's this notion that somehow other people are not as smart, they're not as sensitive, they're not as creative as us. Some of us have had the good fortune to be able to train our minds through formal education, to train our creativity through studying the arts. But the arts are in trouble, I believe, when they divide people, when the artist cuts himself or herself off from, you know, their fellow human beings. And so, you know, one of the things I said is that, let us say that, you know, 5 or 10% of the U.S. population, you know, you're still talking about 30 million people, you know, and, when you're talking to 0.1%, do you really think that human intelligence, sensitivity, and creativity only occurs in the English department?
Right. I'm talking with Dana Gioia, who's an internationally known poet and a great leader in our country for all things humane. And I should have mentioned music as well, because he's written opera libretti in addition to poems and criticism. Dana, I want to listen to one more of your I guess it's a recitation. I want to call it a song from your CD recently released, or actually released just a few days ago. Let's listen. Do you want to set up this one? It's the one entitled Pity the Beautiful.
Yeah, Pity the Beautiful was actually the first lyric that I wrote for Helen. And on the album, first she has me recite it, and then you hear it become a song. You know, literally while the poem is still going on, the music starts coming off, the voices come in, and gradually they become a song.
And what we're going to do is we're going to listen to all of the recitation of the poem, and then we're going to go directly into a few minutes of it becoming a song in the next cut. So let's take a listen.
Pity the beautiful, the dolls and the dishes, the babes with big daddies granting their wishes. Pity the pretty boys, the hunks and Apollos, the golden lads whom success always follows, the hotties, the knockouts, the tens out of ten, the drop-dead gorgeous, the great leading men. Pity the faded, the bloated, the blousy, the paunchy Adonis whose luck's gone lousy. Pity the gods, no longer divine. Pity the night, the stars lose their shine.
First cut of Dana Gioia, who's on the phone with me, of his lyric, Pity the Beautiful, and immediately went into the jazz improvisation of Helen's song. Dana, who is the vocalist?
Well, there's, you know, I've got to get this right because we changed the personnel. You know, this one is Gene Baylor, who is, you know, is the guest vocalist on there. And some of these, you know, we actually have two vocalists, and then Christy Daschle. And the two of them, you know, sort of trade the song back and forth.
I want to say, we've got about a minute left in this part of the interview, but I do want to say, from the first time I met you so many years ago, your ability to recite not just your poetry, but any poetry you read was so remarkable, and it stood out so much. It really reminded me of those days of Homer's bards who would stand in front of the fire and recite the stories of Troy and Aeneas, and, well, not Aeneas, but of Troy and Odysseus to the gathered Greeks. And quickly, have you always had this gift?
Well, I came to poetry hearing my mother recite poems. And she would recite Annabel Lee by Edgar Allan Poe, or she would recite Maud Mullen, or the opening to Evangeline. So poetry has always been musical to me. It's been performative to me. And then, you know, as a young man, or as a kid, you know, Sister Camille Cecilia, you know, taught me piano from second grade on. In fact, I have a book coming out next year called The Catholic Writer Today and Other Essays, and I have dedicated it to my parochial school music teacher and my eighth grade, sister, these two sisters of Providence, and thank them for giving me poetry and piano.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We're all grateful to our teachers along the way. We'll be back with Dana Gioia after a brief message.
We talk all the time about the culture war, don't we? Have you ever stopped to think about what the culture war is being fought over? Some people say the culture war is waged over big government versus small, or tax cuts versus tax increases, or pro-Second Amendment versus anti-Second Amendment, or prayer in schools versus secular-only public education. There's truth in all of these. I propose that the real culture war, the overarching conflict, is between those who think contraception is a blessing and those who think that love and life belong together. From that seemingly minor disagreement flows every other cultural battle. Think about it. If birth control is a good thing, if fertility can be made sterile, it's awfully hard to argue against homosexual behavior, divorce and remarriage, and the very redefinition of marriage. The logic is inexorable. I'm Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
Mr. Pro-Life, Joe Schreiber, was one of the speakers of the Pro-Life Summit last January.
First of all, I have to say, you have to know your enemy. When I was new in the movement and people didn't recognize me, I would go to the abortionist conventions. I'd just sign in, pay my enormous entrance fee and get a badge, and go to all their meetings. And I knew what they were planning. I knew what they were doing. And I went to a number of these until it reached a point where I was recognized, and so I would get other people to go. And then they made it hard to get in.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. On our program this week, Dr. Peter Williamson teaches on St. Paul's letter to Titus. And from the Pro-Life Summit, Joe Schreiber addresses the church militant in the age of Obama, saving babies' lives when the head of state is trying to make it easier to eradicate them. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Writer, speaker, Dana Gioia, now recording artist, looking for his first Grammy Award, I think. Dana, we have another piece from this new album entitled Sung with Words, a collaboration with Dana Gioia, and Helen Sung is the main musician heading her group of jazz musicians, and it's by way available on Amazon and available at her website, helensung.com. But set up this next piece we're going to listen to entitled In the Shadowland?
Well, you know, Helen's new album, or our new album, is called Song with Words. You know, it's a pun on her last name. And most of the cuts on it are vocal. They have poetry, they have vocal lines. But In the Shadowlands is an instrumental piece, but it was inspired by words. And in this case, it was inspired by a remark that C.S. Lewis made, you know, about, you know, the life that we have as mortals and the life that we will enjoy in heaven. And Lewis says that, you know, while we are alive, we are in the shadowlands, you know, but in the next world, we'll be in a world of light.
Well, let's listen to what Helen Song and her group of musicians do with that right now. Been listening to one of the cuts from the new album CD download called Sung with Words, a collaboration with Dana Gioia, the poet who's on the phone with us from California. Dana, you think C.S. Lewis would have liked that?
I think he would have loved it.
It certainly does have a shadowish quality as it begins and leads into that beautiful jazz trumpet.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's about the sorrows and challenges of life and the yearning, that we have for salvation.
Yes. And you told me earlier that Helen Song is a religious person.
Yeah, she's a Baptist, you know, and she...
I used to be a Baptist. That's not so bad.
She's quite unusual, I think, in the jazz world. She's a woman. She's Asian, and she's a Christian. I mean, and she's also very, just a really admirable, wonderful, fun person. So it was an honor, a pleasure and a privilege to work with her.
So we want to help people understand the beauty and awaiting them if they buy this new CD. Again, it's called Sung with Words, a collaboration with Dana Gioia. Now, going back to your introduction to the Best American Poetry of 2018, you say that American poetry is a tale of two cities. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that if you're in the official poetry culture, which is basically creative writing departments, poetry looks one way. But if you're outside of the university, the art of poetry seems entirely different. You know, to a certain degree, in the writing programs, the humanities in the university are contracting. The enrollments are going down. There are no job prospects. The discourse and the work has become more and more remote, more and more ideological. But outside, of the university and, all over the country, not just urban centers, but, the whole internet, network which allows people to communicate from anywhere, you see this this diversity, this vibrancy, this, you know, democracy, this enthusiasm for poetry. And so, you know, and if you're some, you know, and there's a lot of people who wanted to get an academic job, they couldn't, and then they sort of did something else, and they felt like they had missed their life as an artist, as a poet.
Oh, there's many people like that out there.
Yeah, there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And what they've discovered is that, you know, they can actually have an active and productive, you know, creative life, you know, completely outside of the official culture, outside of the academic culture. And it's that energy, it's that diversity, that sort of feet on the ground, you know, local energy, which I think has been has revived American poetry.
And in your book, which I haven't seen yet, I assume it's just out, The Best Poetry, American Poetry of 2018?
Yes. Yeah, just came out. We asked it last, you know, we brought it out last week. We launched it in New York. But let me say one thing. I think this is something I need to make clear. I believe that a good writer can write in a way that's accessible without condescension. It's not, you aren't dumbing it down. What you are is opening it up. And that's how Frost wrote. That's how Shakespeare wrote. You know, that's how Duke Ellington composed. And I think we get ourselves into this dead-end street when we say we suddenly believe that the audience isn't smart enough to understand our genius. Well, maybe our genius needs a little bit of tutoring. You know?
Well, also, it's just good writing itself demands that it communicate with different levels of educated readership. This is why, even though I read the Times Literary Supplement, I have a hard time plowing through the prose. It's so often so convoluted. Sometimes it's beautiful, very good writers, but sometimes it's just academese.
Yeah, you can, by the first paragraph, you almost always know whether the writer cares about the audience. So, you know, but anyway, you know, as I'm touring all these rural cities in California, you know, I share with them challenging poems, and they are there because people bring their life experience to a work of art, and you either recognize and honor that experience, or you respect it, perhaps, you know, recognize and respect that experience, or you just, you know, deliver a soliloquy. And, you know, I want art to be a conversation, not a soliloquy.
And not a assignment.
Yes, definitely not an assignment to write a term paper.
Right.
But I think part of the aversion, you know, the average American has to poetry is that the last time they read it, they had to write a paper about it. And, you know, if they had to write a paper about every song they, you know, they heard, every movie, you know, they went to, they'd probably stop,
theaters would be empty.
Yeah. So, you know, our engagement with art, our engagement with poetry should not primarily be intellectual. It's experiential. A poem has the ability, a good poem, a great poem, surely, to speak to us across the full range of our humanity. We speaks to our intellect, to our emotions, to our intuition, to our imagination, to our physical body, to the rhythms and music, and to our own memories. So each person can bring, as it were, the memory of their own life, and the poem will find room for your memories. And so it's a kind of conversation that allows you to be a complete human being, mm-hmm. and doesn't simply talk to you as a, you know, as an analytical.
It's organic to you.
Bodiless mind. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm reading Ronald Knox's book, Enthusiasm. Right?
Oh yeah.
You know, about all these heresies, and one of the chief philosophical mistakes, theological mistakes, that happens again and again in history of Western thought is that people want to divide the human being into a good spirit and a bad body, as if God made a blunder when he made us incarnate in flesh, as if God made a blunder.
You know, the old Gnostic heresy.
Yeah, it's Gnosticism, it's Manichaeanism. And, I think as Catholics we understand that we are body and soul, and a poem should speak to us in the entirety of our humanity and allow us, in a sense, to glory in the range of our faculties.
There was another sentence you wrote in your introduction to the Best American Poetry of 2018. You say this: technology has allowed poetry, which had developed in pre-literate societies as a spoken art, to reconnect with its auditory origin. Print now coexists with equally powerful media for poetry. So you're saying something that a lot of people overlook, and that is, you know, with all the criticism of people being on social media and spending all their time in front of screens, this platform has actually been very beneficial to poetry and probably many of the other arts.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've said probably ad nauseum, over the last, quarter century, is that, poetry is this ancient art. It's developed, it's perfected before they even have writing. And, and it's a poetry, song, or one art. It's performative, it's musical, it's auditory. In the 20th century, poetry became largely a typographic art. It's a book art, in some cases, which was meant to be read silently. And you can write wonderful poems that way, but they tend to be poems that don't have the appeal that spoken musical just think of something right now. It's if you look at a poem on the page, where is that poem? It's outside of you. If you hear it, where is that poem? It's inside you. There's a very different, this is where, two great Catholic thinkers, Marshall McLuhan and Father Walter Ong,
right,
so powerfully correct about the nature of orality. You know, when Jesus spoke to the multitudes, he didn't write anything down. He spoke to them. You know, he told them stories. He gave, poems like the Beatitudes. He gave them, sort of verbal wisdom. And so we have a very different relationship to hearing things. And so I think what's happened right now is the new technology, CDs, videos, YouTube, radio, like what you're doing, has increased the oral nature of poetry. So, I didn't say this earlier, but one of the reasons that poetry is becoming more popular is that it's now less poetry printed on a page and more poetry that is loud and live and musical. Now, that being said, the NEA numbers are still talking about what people are reading on the page, but they're reading a different sort of poetry. Poetry's become more musical. 30 years ago, I and other poets were attacked whenever we put rhyme in a poem. They said rhyme was un-American, rhyme was repressive. Now everybody rhymes again. People use meter again. So it's the rediscovery of poetry's auditory origins, its musical nature, and its deep kinship with song.
Dana, isn't it the case that up until the time of St. Augustine, when people read at all, they read out loud?
Oh, yeah. I mean, St. Ambrose points that out, that there's this one guy in the monastery, and they cannot figure him out. He seems to be reading silently, and no one's ever seen this. And that's, so we know,
right,
at least, in the 4th century, the people, and so if you think about this in the ancient world, and I think this is true in the medieval world, writing was like a musical score. The person saw it and spoke it aloud. Now, once we had mechanical, part of that is the difficulty of reading anybody's writing, the expensive paper where they'd run words together. Once you got into, let's say, 1700, when suddenly paper and mechanical technology had made books affordable, you have the beginning of what we now call print culture, where it's books, and then increasingly as it gets towards the 20th century, it becomes silent reading. A novel is generally meant to be read silently. But what happened is that, I think that print culture allowed poets to do lots of things they hadn't done before, but also gradually began limiting their appeal because they were writing for the eye, for the intellect, rather than for the whole human mechanism.
Dana, one thing I've noticed, I've been a very enthusiastic audiobook listener now for 2 decades, And I've noticed on Audible, which is the main source of audiobooks for most people, that there's now brand new recordings, say, of all the poetry of T.S. Eliot by Jeremy Irons. There seems to be an uptake in recording poetry.
Well, you know, just go onto the YouTube. I mean, you can almost put any poem, you know, put Dana Gioia on the YouTube. You'll get some of me reciting it, but you'll get high school kids reciting it. You'll get people I've never met reciting it.
That must be a great feeling.
Well, it is, but it's not me uniquely. I mean, you can, you know, all these poets, and so you've recreated this, and this, you know, there are these series of, like, some, you know, some people will just make a video after video of them reciting their favorite poems, you know, and they're just doing it for their friends.
And they're doing it for fun, you know?
Yeah, they're bringing joy and spontaneity and kind of grassroots enthusiasm, you know, into the literary space. And so, you know, I think that YouTube, you know, has become, you know, this really very powerful medium for poetry. And, you know, and I pointed out the Yale Review, you know, fine magazine, Johns Hopkins Review, another fine magazine, I'm not demeaning the magazines, they have circulation under 1,000. There are high school kids that have just recorded themselves, you know, reciting a poem, and they have, you know, they can have 10,000 hits. So, you know, the culture is shifting, and I think people today, again, are much more like our grandparents, that what a poem is something that you recite, you know, you share, you know, and if you think about that, when you're reciting, you're usually reciting to someone. I've always thought that the most powerful way a poem ever communicates to me is when somebody says, you know, I really love this poem, Dana, and they either recite it from memory or they read it to you, and it's person to person, and I never forget those poems. You know,
it's been appropriated by that person. It's been deeply appropriated.
Yeah, and then they share it with you. I mean, I remember I was talking to this investment banker once, and he said, "Well, you know this poem?" And he recited me this poem, actually, by a poet I'd never really heard of. It's just a name I'd seen, but I never read his poetry. Named Coventry Patmore.
Oh yeah,
Catholic Victorian poet, and this poem was beautiful.
Yeah, T.A. Natalis set by Finzi to music.
Yeah, and so.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was Thomas Traherne. I apologize.
Yeah. So Patmore, he did Patmore, you know, elsewhere, but you know and so I said, where did you learn that poem? He says, well, you know, I went to Amherst, and Robert Frost was there one day, and he recited it, and I loved it so much, I went home and learned it. So you think about that. It's Frost giving it to this, you know, this rather famous investment banker. I don't want to mention his name, because it was a, you know, private moment.
Yeah.
And then I did it, and then I fell in love with it. And only about a week ago, I read it to somebody else. And so these poems have this life that is part of human life. And I think, you know, that's a very powerful thing. And I think the electronic media has allowed us to do that.
But talking about the auditory, I remember my conversion to classical music came in a sophomore college class when my aesthetics teacher played Kyrie to Bach's B minor Mass. And watching his face, while he lit the rapture of his face, convinced me I was missing something. So I went out and bought the same recording, and that was the beginning of my journey into classical music.
Well, I think everybody listening probably has a story like this, is that someone took the risk of sharing, you know, a poem, a piece of music, you know, something they found beautiful, something they found moving. And it finds a new home, you know, in one's imagination. That's how it was with my mother. You know, she would recite these poems, and they were, you know, a lot of poems where they were beyond my experience as a, you know, 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, but they were beautiful. They eventually led me to be a poet. And with Sister Mary Damien, I never really had poetry in my education until 8th grade, and she would read poems and she'd make us memorize some poems. And, you know, I didn't ever think I would be a poet at that point, but she gave me this, you know, it's the parable of the sower. You know, she cast these seeds, some fell on stony ground, but some of them took root. And, you know, and that led, in my case, to transforming my life. So I'm very grateful for my teachers.
Oh, yeah. It was my high school janitor that gave me my first copy of Plato and Socrates. Seriously, that was it. And so you say in your essay, social media connects people more effectively than any faculty lounge. How do you take on the critics of social media if they see that kind of statement?
Well, you know, there's all kinds. I mean, social media is whatever the individual makes of it, you know, and there's a lot of downside to it, you know, but there's, you know, positive upside. I mean, and I think a lot of people go into like a university job because they want community. They want to be in a place, you know, where they share values with other people. But what happens a lot of times is everybody's working, you know, in isolation there, and they have relationships with their students, but they often do not have the adult community that they had hoped for in these positions. And, you know, and what social media does, I mean, you have to screen out the bad stuff, and I think you have to protect yourself from it in some ways, but it does allow you to be in touch, you know, with people. You know, and
I think it's cut through a lot of loneliness. I think it's helped a lot of people in their loneliness. There's arguments that say it makes them feel unhappy because they see people going to Acapulco and they're not going. But I've seen a lot of people who are horribly isolated, either because of their health or where they live or even their poverty, who have outlets on things like Facebook.
Well, you know, it's also, you know, YouTube. I mean, I've got all kinds of minor physical ailments, you know, and I do a lot of, you know, kind of, you know, very specific, you know, exercises for my feet, for my legs, and things like this. My hands, I've got terrible arthritis and neuropathy. And I'll go to YouTube there'll be a BBC special, you know, on William Walton or Ray Vaughan Williams.
Yes, it's amazing.
A conversation with, with poets, or there would be, and even, you know, Italian, I'll find some Italian poet, you know.
Right.
You know, a 1-hour Italian special on it. And so suddenly all of these wonderful shows and what performances or composers I know will say, you know, I had a piece premiered in Cincinnati yesterday, and they'll send me a link, and I'll be able to, you know, 1,500 miles away, be able to attend the premiere of a friend's piece or someone singing. And so, you know, it creates this, you know, this sense of, we are asked to be, to accept our neighbors, you know, as family, you know, that we are asked to sort of create community. And I think properly used, social media does that. You know, like everything else in life, improperly used, it can be destructive or alienating or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I think it's a great tool for culture. I think it's a great tool for education. And, and I think certainly in poetry's case, it's had a very powerful impact, you know, on his ability to reach out, and reach out and sort of touch people, who otherwise would be isolated.
Yeah, it pulls them in. It pulls them into something they're hungry for. And they may have been only vaguely hungry, but once they're touched, they realize they're very hungry. Dana Gioia, thanks for being with us today again on Church and Culture. I want to remind our listeners that your latest book of poems is 99 Poems New and Selected, although you have this collection of best American poetry of 2018 that's just been published. And you also, is that right?
Yeah, 99 Poems is my most recent book. Best American Poems, poetry is a selection of other people's poems published in the last 12 months.
With a great introduction by you. And your recording with Helen Sung, jazz musician, is entitled Sung With Words, a collaboration with Dana Gioia. It's available on Amazon and on her own website, helensung.com. Will there be a follow-up?
Well, we'll see. You know, we're still catching our breaths from this one. This morning I was in a conference call with the Scottish Catholic composer James.
Yeah, Lund. He's quite a guy.
And we are working on a big choral orchestral piece that will be used to in the reinauguration of the Crystal Cathedral.
Oh, wow.
which is, which will be, a very beautiful Philip Johnson modern church.
Yeah.
That the Diocese of Orange County has bought and will become the Cathedral of Orange County.
Well, that's very big news, and I thank you for letting us all know about it. And, of course, we'll be back in touch about that and other things. And thanks again, Dana, for being with us from California. And to the rest of you, hang around for a few moments. I'll be back with another wonderful guest.